Hello, this is Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull in the studio for Benefit.
When we first started playing, you know, back in 68 at the Marquee Club, all the various record companies and producers were wheeled in to see us, and none of them liked the band. There was one notable producer for a major record company who was brought in to see the band and stayed for about 5 minutes and told our managers, they'll never make it in a million years, was the quote. And hopefully he lived to regret it, but we didn't really have any luck at all. I mean, nobody was interested in the band from a recording point of view, so Terry Ellis actually borrowed, I think Terry's father actually went to his bank and borrowed some money on Terry's behalf. I think he borrowed £500 or £800, you know, whatever it was in those days, sort of $1,500, $1,200, something like that. And we went into a tiny little four-track studios it was back then, and recorded the first album without anybody as a producer or whatever. I mean, we just went in and worked with the engineer. Although a lot of the early albums are actually, the producer is credited as being Terry Ellis, but I think that has to do more with the fact that he managed to come up with some of the money. Terry was in the studio, you know, sometimes here and there to sort of, kind of keep morale up, but otherwise was never involved creatively in that capacity. So over the first few albums, the actual production per se was something that I became interested in, and obviously have continued to this day. But no, record companies were very wary of bands that produced themselves or even wrote all their own songs or whatever. I mean, it wasn't that easy. But dare I say, the same thing is true today, that if a band goes out to try and get a record deal and announce that A, they don't have a manager, B, they produce their own records and also engineer them, because it's, record companies like the security of knowing there is a name producer behind it who's going to keep things and deliver on time and suitable quality. There's also something to blame, but I'm feeling usually it's the band who get blamed, not the producer. Producers always seem to get off unscathed.
Thank you.
Well, it was memorable if for no other reason than the fact that we didn't actually play very many gigs anywhere, because we had an American agent, but we arrived in America, I think, with only one, or maybe two. I think we had a Fillmore East show and one other thing in a club in New York. Other than that, we had no dates as such set up. So the whole thing was a rather uneasy and tense 13-week period of playing maybe once or twice a week if we could find somewhere to play, and raced all over America supporting other bands and playing in clubs and small halls, doing whatever we could just to get noticed. Obviously, there wasn't much money about, and we shared rooms, and generally speaking, sort of sat in hotels most of the time, so we couldn't really afford to go out. And as I remember, it was pretty early in the year. It was also very cold on the East Coast, so we were... It wasn't a terribly great time. You know, I think at the end of that, we thought, oh, is this what being successful in America is all about? You know, we sort of thought, well, maybe we should have stayed at home. But we came back and gave it another shot later in the year. And I think on our second tour, we actually managed to break even, because we did have a few dates. And by then, we were in a position to get a decent gig. I think it was the second or maybe the third tour that we went out and supported Led Zeppelin throughout their first arena tour. They had become sort of enormous in that period of time. So we played 35 minutes in front of Led Zeppelin every night, which gave us a great deal of exposure to an audience who, believe it or not, back in those days used to turn up at 8 o'clock for an 8 o'clock show. They used to come and see the support group in those days. And, you know, so we definitely made an impression that way. And when we later came back, I think in 1970, we too were sort of moved up a step into the smaller halls, theatres and so on. And we too had a support group of our own who, if I remember rightly, were a band called Yes. Yeah, we did actually. I seem to remember too. Yes, we did actually play, I think, Aqualung and My God, possibly at that time on stage, although they weren't recorded. We did try them out during the Yes tour. But the Yes tour was memorable, if, again, for nothing else other than Tony Kaye's Paper Underpants, which, because in those days there weren't sort of separate dressing rooms, we had to change in one room. And I do remember this rather strange keyboard player who wore paper disposable underwear. And I've never seen it before, and I've never seen it since. And you're now going to tell me, Redbeard, in fact, you're still wearing some to this very day, and you... It certainly saves on the laundry bill, doesn't it? But it's probably not terribly environmentally friendly, for more than one reason.
Every day there's someone asking, what is there to do? Should I love or should I fight? Is it all the same to you? No, I say I have the answer proven to be true. But if I were to share it with you, you would stand to gain and I'd lose. So I've got nothing to say. Nothing to say. Nothing to say. Every morning, pressure forming all around my eyes. Ceilings crash, the walls collapse, broken by the lies that your misfortune brought upon us, and I won't disguise them. So don't ask me, will I explain? I won't even begin to tell you why. No, just because I have a name, well, I've got nothing to say. It's not my part to criticize or to ask you to be blind to your own pressing problem and the heat you must unwind. And that's got me no answer. There is none that I could give.
Welcome back to In the Studio with Benefit. I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, and you're listening to me and Redbeard.
Well, it was the first time I was in the position of having to sit down and write all the songs for an album, so I suppose necessity being the mother of invention, there was I really had to get on with it. And I had a few ideas from the period when Mick was in the band, which were ideas that probably I floated past him but didn't really strike a responsive chord in that direction, because Mick was more of a kind of blues and jazz oriented guy. He didn't take to the slight nuances of folk or classical music, and I just felt back then that something to steer us away from being just another blues band or just a blues band with a flute player, you know, would be a good idea. So when Mick left the band, I mean, let us not be coy about this, Mick Abrahams was ejected forcefully from the group because he decided that he didn't want to play more than three nights a week, and he definitely said that there was no way he was going to travel abroad or, you know, go to America or anywhere like that. And the rest of us, of course, were a bit dismayed by that approach, because we all wanted to get as many dates as we could. If it meant playing every night of the week, then that was fine by us, and if we got a chance to go and see some other parts of the world, then again, that was the whole point of the exercise. So we tried to talk him into making more of an effort, but he didn't, and things came to a head when one day, having had his mother ring up to say that he was ill and couldn't come to the fourth gig of that week, we had to cancel the show, and Clive Bunker, the drummer, later found him in a cinema in Luton with his girlfriend. I mean, with Mick's own girlfriend, not with Clive's. We won't compound the problem by telling the story wrongly. But Mick did actually do the unforgivable thing of pretending to be ill and causing a cancellation. So after that, we all decided he would have to go, and so we the other three of us explained politely that we really had to find another guitar player. But Mick went on to some moderate success with a group called Bloodwind Pig, and over the years he's played a bit here and there between stints as being a lifeguard, an insurance agent, and an investment advisor, believe it or not. It was received pretty well. I mean, we released the album I think at the beginning of maybe it was in the middle of 1969, but at any rate, it was at a time when we were still very active in the US in that year. I think we did three tours, you see, in 69 in America. So Stand Up didn't really get any tour support from us, but nonetheless, it did. In fact, I can remember at the risk of dropping more names, but I can remember sitting in Lowe's Midtown Hotel on 8th Avenue in New York, and Joe Cocker came in to breakfast, sort of rather bleary-eyed, and said, "Hey, congratulations, your album's just gone to number one." So he was, in fact, the bringer of the good news that we actually had a number one album in the UK while we were away in the States. Well, I think what happened was that there were some things on the Stand Up album which were riff-oriented, things like A New Day Yesterday, which had sort of prominent, you know, big-sounding guitar riffs. And we, having spent a year playing around America, I think that kind of approach had become distilled into a sort of riff-rock kind of feel, and I think we just took that further on the Benefit album into doing a number of songs that employed fairly prominent guitar riffs, you know, with or without flute accompaniment as well. And because we were also playing with people like Mountain, who, I mean, you will recall, there was a lot of the Cream sort of influence in there, Eric Clapton and Felix was in that group as well, and you know, there was a sort of Jack Bruce influence on Felix, both in his bass playing and his singing, and obviously Eric Clapton influenced Leslie West a great deal. So there was, again, that sort of continuity of something British that bounced back to America and then kind of also rubbed off on us a bit, because you know, we just spend a whole tour touring with a band like Mountain. You know, we probably mutually sort of learned a few new tricks from working with each other.
Did I bring along?
because that was me playing the other guitar on the Bedefin album. I mean, a lot of those tracks were Martin Barr and myself playing, you know, when we recorded them on the backing tracks, you know, we would I'd be playing guitar as well, playing the other part. And when it came to doing it on stage, then Martin had to do the whole thing and therefore had to try and find what seemed to be the prominent line that emerged out of the two and just go for one sort of composite part. But the same thing happens even now, you know, if there are two guitar parts or whatever on a record now, exactly the same problem. You still have to try and distill it into one single part when it comes to doing live on stage. Although we have the benefit at the moment of a keyboard player who also plays guitar as well, so you know, we can sort of cover some of the double guitar parts that way. But I try to avoid playing electric guitar on stage. Just another set of strings to have to change every day and another thing to go wrong, so I just leave it all to Martin on stage and play acoustic guitar.
You there to help me, then it probably will.
be what I want to be. Just 1 week for the feeling to go. And with you there to help me, it probably will.
Hello, this is Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull in the studio for Benefit.
We used to do a lot of things. It was always like trying to make things up in the studio, you know, always trying to find a new way of getting a sound. But you only had very simple things to work with. So sometimes you would do something and think, oh, that was a good idea. Then you'd try to get another song, having forgotten how you did it or being unable to recreate that particular effect. Because I, again, not having the benefit of the record, just to, no pun intended, to listen to now, I would guess that's probably one where I'm singing through a Leslie cabinet, you know, one of those rotating speaker cabinets they used to get with Hammond organs. In fact, the old Leslie cabinet used to get pressed into service a lot back then. For instance, on the Stand Up album, when we couldn't afford, in fact, we didn't have a Hammond organ of our own, let alone a Leslie cabinet, we tried to simulate that as a way of getting a rotating speaker guitar sound, and we did it by putting two guitar speakers in the room facing each other and swinging. I can remember while Martin was doing his guitar solos, I was actually swinging the microphone on its lead round and round so that it went, you know, in a circle between the two speakers, giving a similar sort of effect. So we used that then. I think I used Leslie cabinets on some flute bits and pieces, and certainly used it for vocals on a few songs. So that's what that would have been, and that was, of course, these days you get the same sort of range of effects from devices, you know, an inch and three quarters high that you can slip into a rack and cost you a couple of $100s and produce chorus and flanging effects that back then were very experimental techniques obtained usually by jiggery-pokery or, you know, forcing tape machines to run slow and fast and doing all sorts of dreadful things mechanically to them to make them produce those odd qualities of sound. But, you know, I mean, it was all back then in the studio, you were always looking for new ways of using very limited technology. And so it was inventive, although somewhat destructive in terms of equipment.
Thank you.
it was actually two. It was one song, but it was actually recorded twice on separate occasions. One as the B-side of a UK single, when it actually had a longer running length and I think some extended middle section. And it was recorded in a shorter version. Or maybe I got it the wrong way around. Maybe the longer version was what ended up being on the American album. I forget, but whatever, the original American album, I think, was different to the one that was on the UK album, which was the UK single. But it was recorded, you see, as one of the things that we did when we were recording Benefit, and didn't appear in the US, if memory serves me right, until the Living in the Past album, which was subsequent to Aqualung. I think I've got that chronologically correct. But no, it was it was done, you know, on two very separate occasions. It wasn't just two takes. It was actually a re-recording done some days later. It was done as a more concise version as a B-side for the UK single, I think, The Witch's Promise. And I've got a feeling that when it came to putting it on the boxed set last year, that I made a point of using the version that the American record buyers would not have been familiar with. So whichever one we hadn't used on the US album, then that's the one we used last time out.
Oh, lend me your ear while I call you a fool. You were kissed by a witch one night in the wood, and later insisted your feelings were true. His promise was coming, believing he listened while laughing you flew. Leaves falling red, yellow, brown, all over the same. And the love you had found lay outside in the rain. Washed clean by the water, but nursing his pain. The witch's promise was coming, and you're looking elsewhere for your own selfish gain. It's only fair. He was willing to appear to you, you didn't care. You're waiting for more, but you've already had your share. The witch's promises turned in, so don't you wait up for him, he's going to be late.
Hi, welcome back to In the Studio with Benefit. I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, and you're listening to me and Redbeard.
You know, back then, sound systems and staging and lighting and everything was very much in its infancy in terms of rock and roll concerts. So you would tend to have nights when things worked out okay and nights when it was, technically speaking, pretty disastrous. So it was very up and down. And that wasn't just us. I mean, it applied to other bands as well. I mean, I can remember when we were opening for Jimi Hendrix, you know, he was plagued by problems, you know, on consecutive nights. He'd have a, you know, totally different level of performance. I mean, when he was good, he was fantastic. But when things went wrong for him technically, he was, it was dreadful, you know, and he knew it was dreadful and he used to, you know, really lose heart. Same thing happened with Zeppelin when we were supporting them. You know, they would have nights when the PA system wasn't working properly or amplifiers would break down, and they used to, you know, I mean, they went to pieces, you know, and did not, on some nights, really deliver the goods. I think our approach was probably that, you know, you just couldn't afford to be upset by these things. You had to battle on. But it was very up and down. I mean, we used to come off stage some nights feeling quite unhappy, you know, really, really tragically unhappy about the level of performance, which you just felt thwarted in because of technical problems. But that seems to be the most memorable aspect of all that period of time, was that you were fighting what seemed to be a, on average, losing battle with the very primitive technical side of the equation. You know, the equipment of the day basically was not reliable and, you know, was not from night to night. It was hard to have continuity. So I'm sure there are audiences who will remember seeing us back then and thought that, you know, it must have sounded bloody awful. Other audiences may have been to concerts where you know, everything worked okay and remembered as sounding all right. But it was very difficult, particularly as a flute player, because without adequate monitoring, I mean, I could never hear what I was playing. When I can't hear what I'm playing, I tend to play some overly adventurous solos because I play by ear, and if I can't hear what I'm playing, I've no idea where I am, which key I'm in or anything, so...
You and
There was, again, I think this was on our first UK tour, because we were away from the UK, and we knew we would be most of that year. Our manager, Terry Ellis, the other manager, requested that I should go into my hotel room and try and write a single for the UK market, since being away, it seemed like the only way to kind of keep the identity of the group in front of the public. So that's the only time I've ever actually really gone to specifically write something as a single. And it was an odd sort of a single because it was in 5/4 time, which is kind of difficult to dance to. And it wasn't exactly the most commercial sounding thing in the charts that year, but it did sort of make it to, I don't know, number 3 or something in the UK charts. But that was a song called Living in the Past. But it took some considerable length of time before it was released in the US. I think Warner Brothers passed on that at the time and didn't feel that it was the right thing. So it was about 3 years later, I think, it came out in the US as a single. Why the title Benefit? Ah, well, that's an easy one to answer because actually it's nothing whatsoever to do with me. I always thought it was a really rotten title, but it was Terry Ellis in his executive producer capacity came up with the idea of calling it Benefit because I think that was about the start of the sort of idea of benefit concerts, you know, like people were actually doing concerts in aid of this or in aid of that. And just think, if people had done all their benefit concerts back there for the rainforest, we wouldn't have a problem at all now, would we? Could have paid off those farmers long time ago. I think he got it from that idea and wanting to call it Benefit because it seemed, you know, like a sort of, generous and sort of groovy kind of title for something that seemed to suggest it was, going to be free, which was the vogue of the day. Mind you, the standard of equipment I was talking about, it should have been free. But no, we did actually get paid for it, and we got paid for the record as well. But I never liked the title because it seemed to me a sort of a rather strange one. Also, the album cover was of his making as well, the sort of stand-up, the little sort of stick-on figures on a kind of cardboard stage. And I remember, I don't know if you've seen the Spinal Tap movie, but it was a bit, when we actually saw, how it was described to us being this wonderful sort of, wonderful cover, you know, that had been designed, and it was supposed to be like a very elaborate toy theatre stage. And when we actually saw it, we looked at it in the same way as the members of Spinal Tap looked at each other when they saw the stage set for Stonehenge. I don't know if you remember the movie. So it was a bit, we thought, whoops, you know, oh dear. But it was too late because we were such a rush to get the record out, we had to go with it. And it was a pretty, looking back on it today, it's not one of our best album covers. I think it was actually after that that I think I got determined that album covers better come within the role of my, at least overseeing in terms of content. And I felt they got a bit better after that.
Going back to be all the things you want to be. While in sweet dreams you softly sigh. You hear my voice is calling to be mine again. Let the rest of your life be a day. Mommy's at home sleeping. No time to understand, 'cause they lost what they thought they were keeping. Start the car.
Your mom is at home.